pulled back the greatcoat.
That isn't all dirt spattered on their gowns. Something happened, and I'd like to know what. If you can pry it from their lips, I couldn't get it out of them, but if you can...
He lowered his voice.
They look badly used to me, and I've seen some things.
Mary and William turned to one another. They had seen this lifeless look before, in the war. It was more than exhaustion, more than disorientation. It was shock. Mary said, "Officer Farrell, William, could you bring Emma and Claire inside, please?" William and Farrell bent to pick them up. The girls arched their backs, pushing them away with balled fists and kicking so vigorously that William and Farrell released them. The girls scrambled into one another's arms, silent as stones. Amelia reached out a hand to them, but Emma kicked her away. Without a word, Elizabeth turned on her heel and disappeared into the house. No one asked any more questions about where the girls had been since their disappearance, because the answer was obvious. Clearly, Emma and Claire O'Donnell had been residing in hell. A wavering melody, barely discernible, penetrated the shocked silence. Elizabeth was standing at the threshold, her violin tucked under her chin, eyes shut, arm drawing back and forth, her body yielding like a blade of grass, playing Pachelbel, the lyrical canon that Mademoiselle Erso had first played for Elizabeth and William. Emma and Claire both turned their wary gaze on Elizabeth. Time slowed. It happens that way sometimes, when life rearranges itself. From despair to possibility, within a hair's breadth. Amelia nodded to William to lift a becalmed Emma into his arms. William nodded to Farrell, who stooped over Claire like a crane, his long arms gathering her in. The girls allowed themselves to be lifted up, and Elizabeth, seeing this, led them all into the house like a Pied Piper. Chapter 20. "I can tell you've been hurt," Mary said, kneeling in front of Emma. "Someone hurt you, didn't they?" Emma shook her head, and with her thumb wiped dirt from Claire's upturned face. Emma was still trying to decide what to do. She didn't know whether they were safe. Where were their parents? They were the ones she wanted, though she remembered. A long time ago, it seemed, loving Auntie Amelia and Aunt Mary, and feeling safe in this home. And here was Elizabeth, too, who had been gone so long. Had Emma conjured her into being? Paris, her mother had told her, a city across the ocean. But here Elizabeth was, and she had played her violin. But Emma didn't know what was real anymore. Were they really here? And she didn't know who she could trust. She had lost the ability to trust, to believe in anything. For a moment, Elizabeth's music had reminded her, but when it stopped, she forgot again how to think. She didn't know what to do, what to say. Claire would run if Emma said to. Claire would do anything Emma asked. But Emma was so tired. Where would they go? The clean sound of water tumbling into the bathtub spilled from the other room. She remembered the bathtub from nights they had stayed here. Auntie Amelia was drawing a bath, Aunt Mary said now. Had Emma agreed to take one? Had she spoken? She had learned from Claire to say nothing, but they kept asking her questions. She looked at Elizabeth again, at a loss as to whether to believe it really was Elizabeth. She had forgotten how to ask for help, had forgotten even what helped felt like.
We want to help you, Aunt Mary said. Please let us give you a bath. You'll be much warmer if we do, and you'll be safe. I promise. Help. Safe. Could Aunt Mary read minds? With the flicker of an eyelid, a gesture so involuntary that Emma hardly knew she made it, she acquiesced. Did she? She didn't know, but she did not protest when Mary took Claire's free hand in hers and led them both into the steamy room. Water was falling from the tap, a cloud of mist hanging in the air. Emma could feel the seductive promise, the memory of warmth and being clean. She needed that, wanted that because she smelled of sewer. She smelled of him. Let's get those dirty nightgowns off you, Aunt Amelia said. Her voice was bright with kindness. Claire turned to Emma for permission, but Emma didn't give it. Instead, she backed them both against the wooden enclosure of the tub. She didn't know how she was going to get clean with her nightgown on, but she was, and so was Claire. No one could ever make her take her clothes off again. She sidled out of their reach and boosted Claire onto the bathtub frame so that she could slide into the water. Emma slid in behind her, their nightgowns billowing shields they could hide behind. The water was warm and soothing, and she closed her eyes, yielding to the enveloping heat. The water lapped against her, her nightgown clinging to her wet skin. It was then that she heard Aunt Mary and Auntie Amelia gasp. Emma opened her eyes. Her nightgown had turned invisible. They could see her, could see everything. Emma cried out, and when she did, Aunt Mary's face broke. It was the only way Emma could think to describe the way the light in her beautiful eyes fractured, the way her mouth dropped open, as if its hinges had failed, the way Amelia and Mary and Elizabeth saw through the watery, transparent cloth. What a terrible girl Emma had been. The flowering purple stain that engulfed one entire shoulder, the scratches and deeper cuts that cross-hatched her forearms and thighs, the bruising on her hips, all the evidence of her shame. She sank against the warm copper. Now it wasn't that Emma did not want to speak, it was that Emma could not speak, could not form the words to explain what had happened, because she did not want to remember any of it. She felt a little dizzy. What she ought to remember was competing with what she yearned to forget, and it was impossible to keep them straight, especially after last night. They'd broken free, done the terrible thing, and run. Not even the dark night and clanging bells and swirling river had intimidated them, not even the pain or the cold. They'd flown like sparrows, the two of them, taken wing. Aunt Mary reached for towels hanging on a rod above her head. She was moving slowly, as if she had to tell her body what to do and how to do it. Then Aunt Mary and Auntie Amelia both reached into the tub and pulled her and Claire out. No one said anything. From the corner of her eye, Emma could see Auntie Amelia wrapping Claire in a towel and drawing her into her lap. Aunt Mary drew Emma onto hers. She did not hold her too tightly. Emma felt she could leave if she wanted. She could feel tears wetting her hair. Elizabeth had sunk to the floor between them and taken hold of both Claire and Emma in any way she could. We looked everywhere. Everywhere, Aunt Mary was saying. Orphanages. Schools. The police looked, too. Uncle William took the train to Troy and searched every single cranny. I went to Schenectady. We went out at night with lanterns.
We walked up and down the alleys. We took out an ad in the newspapers. We looked in all the hospitals. We looked everywhere. The police thought you had drowned after the blizzard, but I knew you hadn't. Silence roared in Emma's ears, a heavy quiet that blocked out pain. "Am I hurting you?" Mary said, holding her close. Everything hurt, but so much less than anything had hurt in a long time. Mary said, "The water is cooling." The taps were opened again, and the muffled sound of falling water filled the room. Amelia and Mary helped Claire and Emma rid themselves of their wet nightgowns. Amelia ran a frantic gaze over Claire's small body. When she discovered nothing, a scratch here, a rash there, but no bruises, no cuts, no intrusions, Emma swelled with pride. At least she had kept Claire safe. The other man had never touched her. Not once. Mary picked Emma up and eased her again into the water. Mary knelt beside the tub at its edge and ran the soap gently over Emma's arms and legs while she eased her body into the warmth. The water was a balm. Claire was beside her, the water lapping at their waists and then their armpits as they laid back against the curve of the tub. Emma wondered whether you could clean time, too, as you could a body. Whether you could scrub it of everything that had gone before. She slid down to her neck to let her hair drift in the water. "Take as long as you want," Amelia said. "Do you understand? As long as you like. We are here." Mary murmured something about getting her doctor's bag and left the room. Amelia and Elizabeth kneeled beside the tub, and Emma and Claire floated together in the tide of warmth. A long time passed like this. She and Claire locked their hands together and shut their eyes and did not cry. They were together. They were safe. They needed nothing. Only their parents. Soon they would come for them. Emma reached for the soap and lifted Claire's arm and ran the square up and down her skeletal limbs. Nudging Claire forward, she washed her back, gliding over the nubs of her spine. Emma then washed herself, the slippery square melting and gliding over her broken skin, getting caught in the tendrils of her hair. She eased Claire back again and made her float, until only her round, freckled face showed above the soup of suds and water. She ran the soap through Claire's hair with her fingers, working her scalp. How much time passed? Emma didn't know. She was lost in safety, lost in the respite of hot water, lost in the escape from vigilance. In the water, she felt light, when lately her body had felt so heavy. She shut her eyes. Mary came back. Amelia inspected them and said their hair needed to be rewashed. So they kneeled in the tub as she ran clean water over them and rubbed more soap in to sluice away the last of the dirt. They allowed their hair to be tugged and fought with and tamed. New nightgowns appeared as if by magic. They allowed themselves to be dressed. They allowed this, as Emma had been made to allow the other. They were carried out of the bathroom and up the stairs and tucked into clean sheets that smelled of the sun. Mary gave her and Claire a pill to swallow, then went to the door and opened it, and called for someone and asked for food. In a little while, a tray appeared with plates of scrambled eggs and ham and mugs of warm milk, and they ate the food from the tray set on a low table between their two beds. They ate too fast, trying to extinguish the flame of want. When they could eat no more, they let go their spoons and lay back against their pillows, and closed their eyes. It had been an eon since they had slept for longer than a few hours at a time. Emma left her bed and climbed into Claire's and spooned herself against her sister's curled body. Light spilled through the windows. The light was so beautiful that Emma did not want to shut her eyes. She had been in darkness so long. She lifted her head and looked at Mary, who leaned forward, her face a question mark. Still, Emma couldn't speak. "Ah," Mary said, "don't worry. I won't leave. I promise. You can sleep." So Emma did. Chapter 21. Viola Vanderveer hurried ahead to open the door to her son's room as one of the servants carried Jacob in and laid him on his bed. She had collected eiderdown quilts from the other bedchambers, and now she peeled away Jacob's wet evening clothes, toweled him dry, and piled 5 quilts on top of his prostrate form. "Call for a doctor," Viola said to the butler, who had raced up the stairs behind her. "One of the doctors, Stip. They're just across the park, on Madison. Hurry!" The butler turned on his heel, his coattails whipping behind him as he barked orders to the other servants to bring warming bricks and to stoke the fire. Viola stroked her son's stubbled cheek. It was frigid to the touch. His eyes blinked open and shut. She reached for his hands to warm them, but her own hands were still numb from having spent the entire night on State Street. Though she had worn her fur hat and gloves and hugged the carriage blanket around her shoulders, toward 3 in the morning she had grown so cold that she left the carriage and began to pace in an effort to warm herself. Garrett had come and gone after buying a lantern from one of the nearby stores, opened by its proprietor in a burst of entrepreneurial genius to serve the anxious crowds. An enterprising chestnut roaster had trundled his cart to a corner and fired up his brazier, and she had gone and purchased several for herself and her driver to hold in their hands. From time to time, Garrett returned and reported on the state of the flood. Furious with him for sending Jacob into the district, she pummeled his chest with her fists. Toward dawn, Garrett departed on another reconnaissance mission and did not return. Alone, she sat vigil another 3 hours, her heart in her throat, hardly able to breathe as the waters edged up Broadway. And then, at 9, Jacob stumbled out of the floodwaters like an apparition, carrying those accursed books with him. Now Viola rubbed her stiff hands together and kneaded Jacob's shoulders and arms and urged him to talk, trying to will him back from the edge of unconsciousness. Servants hurried in with warmed bricks wrapped in towels. Viola nestled them close to Jacob's body. A fire roared in the fireplace. Someone brought hot tea.
"Jacob, please, darling, wake up. Can you wake up and drink some tea?"
His eyes fluttered open.
"Jacob?"
His voice was slurred and raw.
"Are you all right?"
"Me?"
she said, incredulous.
"How are you?"
"I think I will never be warm again."
She gasped with laughter, relieved.
"What happened?"
"Father wanted the books, but Harley didn't come. I had to save the lumber."
He shut his eyes again and drifted away. Downstairs, a flurry of voices, punctuated by Garrett's roaring bray, carried up the stairwell. Viola handed the cup of tea to a hovering maid and said,
"Make him drink this."
She flew down the 3 flights to the foyer, where Garrett sat slumped against the wall, his legs thrust out before him. His hands were sickly white, his bald head was moist with sweat, his lips chapped, and his face a ruby blister of chilblains. Slashed above his left eye was a bloody welt that a maid was attempting to stanch with her apron, while a footman knelt before Garrett, unlacing his sodden boots. His clothes were soaked through.
I couldn't find him,
Garrett muttered, shivering.
It's all right. He is home, Viola said.
But he appeared unrelieved by the news that Jacob was safe.
Did you hear me? Jacob's home. He's safe. Where did you go? What happened?
Slipped. Fell in the water. Knocked my head against a lamppost.
What were you doing?
Searching, he said.
Call for more help, would you please?
Viola asked the footman, who had managed to yank off the second of Garrett's boots. The footman hastened outside and returned with a stable hand. They crossed and linked their arms together and bore Garrett up the three flights to his room. Garrett, like Jacob, was shivering uncontrollably, and Viola tugged off his wet socks, then the wet canvas work clothes he'd changed into after the party, and then his underclothes. She threw a quilt over him and leaned out the door and pleaded with a maid to unearth more. He had dropped the apron, and the cut was bleeding profusely. Viola ripped a pillowcase off a pillow and bunched it against his forehead.
Why didn't you go to the hospital?
She said.
You're bleeding.
Garrett wrenched the pillowcase from her hands. He stared at the bloodstain, then held it against his forehead himself.
It's nothing. I've had worse.
I thought you were both gone.
Well, neither of us is, are we?
Garrett said, scowling.
You said Jacob's fine?
He is so cold. I sent for one of the doctor's stip.
Garrett winced as he raised one eyebrow.
The stips? Are they coming?
I hope so.
He pushed himself up to one elbow, yanking the quilt to his neck.
Did anyone die? Has everyone been evacuated?
I don't know, Viola said. No one knows.
Damn! He yelled. My new ice yacht! Oh, why didn't I think of her? Damn! She's gone now!
A footman arrived with more warming bricks and muscled them under the covers and set about hunting for a nightshirt for Garrett. Viola left the footman, cajoling Garrett to dress. Jacob, thank God, was sitting up in bed. A maid had brought him a breakfast tray of boiled eggs and toast and a full pot of coffee. He had stopped shivering and could speak now without slurring.
Did I hear Father? He said.
He slipped in the water, looking for you. He's got a cut above his eye.
Did he go out onto the ice?
I don't know.
Her voice caught in her throat. Last night, she had pictured losing Jacob over and over. And now here he was, safe.
Dr. Stipp should be here soon.
I'm all right,
Jacob said, reaching for her and pulling her to him.
I thought I'd lost you, she said,
laying her head on his shoulder. He used to do that when he was little, when he was frightened.
I'm here, he said.
I couldn't bear it, she said.
She had been so selfish of late, had asked too much of him. But last night she had made it through the entire party without a drop of sherry, braving the scrutiny of her guests. She was glad that she had, for she had her wits about her when Garrett refused to take her to the river with him. She had fought him and won. Jacob let go and fell back against the pillows.
I'll never be warm.
I'll have them draw a hot bath. Try to eat, if you can.
She floated back and forth between her two patients. For his part, Garrett was refusing food but had downed two cups of black coffee. Unlike the noisy flurry of Garrett's arrival, Viola did not know William Stipp had arrived until he knocked on Garrett's open door, his bag in hand.
Despite your misadventure, Garrett, your brain is intact,
the doctor said after examining him. He'd asked Garrett a series of questions, waved a lit match in front of his eyes.
But we need to stitch that gash.
He doused a needle in alcohol and guided a length of catgut into the needle's eye.
I'm surprised you even dared to go near the river, Garrett. Someone who works as close to it as you knows how dangerous it can be. I'm not afraid of the river,
Garrett said, throwing off his covers. Dr. Stipp pushed him back against the pillow.
Be still and drink this, he said, handing him a shot of whiskey he'd ordered from a footman.
Garrett grimaced under the pricks and tugs of Stipp's needle, as the doctor warned that sometimes deeper injuries took a while to reveal themselves, and that it was best if Garrett rested for at least the rest of the day, if not tomorrow, too. Wrapping Garrett's head with gauze to keep the bandage in place, he said to Viola,
If he is not himself, or you cannot wake him, call for me immediately. I'll take him to City Hospital and put a trephine in to lower pressure in his skull. But I'm being overly cautious. I think he's suffered only a mild bump. I put in 5 stitches, but only out of an abundance of caution. During the war, we wouldn't have paid such a slight wound any attention.
There was so much blood, Viola said.
Garrett scoffed.
There wasn't that much blood. Viola lives for drama. I tried to dissuade her from calling you, but you know how ladies can be.
Viola flushed at Garrett's lie and said,
Dr. Stipp, could you come now and see Jacob? He was out on the ice all night. He had only his evening cloak. He was so cold. I still don't know how he got to shore.
It's been a night, Dr. Stipp agreed. Mary and I were at the hospital till morning.
He hesitated, as if he were going to say something else, but then decided not to. Too distracted before to notice, Viola saw now how exhausted the doctor was. There were heavy bags under his eyes, and despite his efficient competence, he was moving slowly. He seemed distant, troubled.
Have you heard whether anyone else was hurt? Garrett said. In the city. Anyone missing? No numbers yet, but there were quite a few injuries. Mostly from panic. Fractures, that sort of thing.
Oh, he said, turning away from the door.
Forgive me, I forgot. Your foreman. Mary was going to send you a note, but things got a little busy at our house this morning. She and I performed surgery on Mr. Harley earlier today. He suffered a gash to the back of his neck. More serious than yours, Garrett. We stitched him up. He should be fine, if the wound doesn't become infected. Harley!
Garrett's gaze sharpened.
Did he say anything? He wasn't conscious. I have no idea how he got hurt, but he's getting a lot of attention. A reporter is writing him up. He saved 2 children.
Children,
Garrett said.
Whose children? I don't know. Why? I've got a lot of employees who live by the river. They've all got young children, and of course it's them you worry about in a flood, isn't it?
It's children you worry about most times.
Where's Harley now?
City Hospital.
Garrett went as pale as the white walls, and sprang from bed and began to pull clothes from his walnut armoire, agile in spite of his injury.
I have to see him. Have the carriage readied, Viola.
Garrett, get back in bed. Besides, don't you want to see Jacob before you go rushing off to see your overseer? She said.
Garrett turned and scowled, and Viola knew she would pay dearly for her admonition later. He did not like being scolded, especially not in front of anyone.
Don't be an idiot, Garrett, William said. Listen to your wife. Spend at least today in bed. You've had a blow to the head. Drink brandy to burn away the river water. And next time, use a boat like a sensible person. I will allow you, however, to come with us to see your son.
Scowling again, Garrett followed them to Jacob's room, fingering a cut end of suture that had worked through the gauze. Jacob, like Garrett, had donned night clothes. His breakfast tray had been removed, and Viola was relieved to see that he was no longer a ghostly white.
Dear boy, Garrett said, how are you?
I'm fine, Jacob said. What happened to you?
I was looking for you and slipped. Stupid of me. Tell us what happened to you.
As Jacob revealed the details of his ordeal, Viola learned just how close he had come to being killed. As Jacob talked, Dr. Stipp examined him, studying the tips of his fingers for frostbite, ordering him once to be silent so that he could listen to his lungs. Jacob was making light of things, no doubt a show for his father, and perhaps even for the doctor. But Viola detected a wavering hint of fear underneath his bravado, especially when he described his desperate dash across the ice. Jacob ended by nodding at the burlap bag in the corner. Delighted, Garrett asked,
"You got all of them?"
"I did."
He beamed.
"You're a hero. Do you hear, Viola? This one chopped through the roof."
"He nearly died."
"But he didn't, did he?"
William cleared his throat, interrupting the exchange.
"Jacob, I think you'll be fine. But Viola, you must keep watch for pneumonia or any sign of fever. He's been chilled to the bone." "Now," he said, snapping shut his bag, "if you'll excuse me, I must be off." "Who or what could be more important than my son?" Garrett said. "Call for me if you need anything. And I most emphatically recommend that you do not go to the hospital, Garrett. Mary and I will keep you updated on Harley's condition."
"Harley?" Jacob said.
"He's in the hospital with an ugly cut to the back of his neck," Garrett said.
"He is? What happened?"
"No one knows," Garrett said, jerking his head at the doctor. "He took care of him and he doesn't even know."
"We've imposed on you too long, Dr. Stipp," Viola said. "You must be exhausted. Thank you so much for coming. Please allow me to show you out."
In the hallway, Viola steered William toward the stairwell, but she stopped when they reached it.
"I want to assure you, Dr. Stipp, that I do not exaggerate. Nor do I live, as my husband stated, for drama. He sometimes likes to paint me as hysterical. He thinks me flighty and silly. And perhaps I am. But I was terrified."
The doctor's gaze turned soft with kindness.
"Mrs. Vanderveer, are you all right?"
"I was terribly frightened," Viola said. She felt her knees buckling. "Jacob is my only child."
"He will be all right."
"I apologize," she said, "for my husband's rudeness."
"Remember that he almost lost his son, too. Strain like that will undo anyone. I've heard worse from other patients. I've probably said worse."
"The war?"
"Violence and fright. Loosen tongues."
He paused and cleared his throat.
"Forgive me, but if at any time you need anything, Barry and I are always here."
"Thank you. That's very kind."
When Viola returned upstairs, she found Garrett in his bedroom, dressing. He thrust his arm toward a dangling coat sleeve, but missed and yanked the whole thing off and threw it on the floor.
"What are you doing, Garrett? The doctor said you shouldn't go anywhere."
He turned on her.
"How dare you embarrass me in front of the doctor?"
"He says you should stay in bed."
"Don't you know that we've just lost thousands of dollars? Maybe tens of thousands. I have to see Harley. I have to know what he thinks we should do now."
"What does money matter when we almost lost our son? What possessed you to send Jacob into the district when the ice was breaking?"
There was a new edge to her voice, one she hadn't chanced with him in a long while. Reminiscent of long ago, before she started feeling the avalanche of his scorn. Out of the corner of her eye, she caught sight of herself in the mirror. The filtered light betrayed age. Shallow half-moons bracketed her mouth, and her eyes looked hooded.
"Oh, please, spare me, Viola. No one knew the water would rise that fast. It never does. And if it was too dangerous, he shouldn't have gone in. The boy's got a brain, a good one, that I paid Harvard to give him. And he got himself out of that pickle pretty well. Bloody hell, woman, help me get dressed or get out of the way."
Didn't you hear, Jacob? He thinks the office might have been crushed. He could have been lost to us.
But he's here, isn't he?
Garrett bent over and scooped the jacket from the floor and punched at it to remove dust.
You see what I mean about your penchant for drama?
I was terrified, Garrett. I didn't know where you were. I didn't know if Jacob was alive.
Garrett drew very close.
What? No sherry this morning? Really? For a woman to fall into drink is such a tawdry thing, don't you agree?
Viola started and backed away.
I've learned not to care about the awful things you say to me. And I've also learned not to care about the other women you see, either.
He snorted, apparently unperturbed that she knew.
For God's sake, Viola. There are more important things than how you feel.
He stumbled past her, wrestling with his coat and screaming for the carriage. Viola shut her eyes, fighting an overwhelming desire to sneak into the butler's pantry for some sherry.
Mother? She heard Jacob call. Is that bath ready?
She turned away from the stairwell and made for her son's room, calling for another tray of tea. Chapter 22. It was 2 in the afternoon, and James Harley was slowly coming around. He could determine little of his whereabouts, because sandbags prevented him from turning his head. Indistinguishable voices and the occasional groan of agony filtered above a mild buzz of activity. His neck throbbed, his head ached, and his throat flamed with thirst. He lay in the throes of this discomfort for some time, until he reared up, grabbing at a searing pain scorching the back of his neck. His hand came away with a white square stained with pale, pinkish fluid that smelled of musk. He stared at the strange object, wondering how such a benign thing could cause him so much pain. He turned his head an inch. He was in a square, high-ceilinged room with 3 other recumbent men, and seated next to his bed, a 4th man in need of a change of clothes slept in a chair, his long legs resting on the edge of the bed, his arms knotted in a loose pretzel of repose around a folded newspaper. Whirling with nausea, Harley lay back down. The chair sitter snorted to life, slapping his feet against the floor and throwing his head back in a violent way before coming to full animation with a bracing shake of his head and a scratching paw at his short beard, now drizzled with saliva. He hugged the newspaper to his chest and leaned forward with keen interest.
"You're awake," he announced, in a high, reedy voice. "Do you know how lucky you are?"
"Lucky?" Harley said.
"You're at City Hospital. You're a hero."
The man waggled his newspaper in front of Harley's nose, aggravating the swells of nausea.
"Hero?
Don't be modest, sir. Those little ones would have died if not for you."
"Little ones?"
Harley remembered nothing of little ones.
"Do you have any whiskey?"
His strange companion laughed.
"Thirsty, huh? I'm afraid they frown on whiskey here. All I'll be able to scare up is some weak tea, if that. Think on what happened while I go hunt that down. I want to hear all the details, everything from the moment the waters failed you."
Harley pondered these declarations. Little ones. Hero. Waters. As the man shambled out of sight. Harley heard him imploring someone for tea, how he needed it for the hero. Harley wondered whether he might be dreaming. From the hallway, a harried explanation of a problem with a broken water main was followed with a warning about an expected menace of typhoid. "But no matter," a voice said, "the man, hero or not, couldn't drink for 8 hours after receiving chloroform, and he still had half an hour to go."
"And for goodness' sake, keep him in bed.
When they wake up, they don't know where they are. They can't remember a thing. Keep an eye on him.
Full recollection, or what Harley believed to be full recollection, came suddenly. His feet hit the cold floorboards. The room reeled. He made it as far as the door before he sank to his knees.
"Hey now, hey," said the high, reedy voice. "You can't be getting out of bed. Ye gods, man, you can't be so brave as all that, can you? Going to look for them again, eh? Don't worry, don't worry. The little ones are fine. They're fine."
His strange companion knelt and helped Harley up, then let loose a low, thin whistle.
"Dear God, that cut is still ugly. What did you do with your bandage?" "Where are they now?" Harley squawked. "The little ones? With their mother." "Oh, they can't be." "Rest easy, Harley. You saved them."
"I saw it in the papers, by God. They buried them just the other day, the whole family.
No one's had time to bury anyone. And everyone survived. They had good warning. Don't you remember those bells?"
Harley remembered no bells. He aimed for the bed, one knee catching on the disarranged sheets. The room continued to spin as the stranger settled him against the hard edges of the sandbags. Harley said,
"Are they at the house? They shouldn't be alone. They'll be frightened."
"God, man, you're in bad shape. That chloroform plays tricks, doesn't it? They're not at their house."
"But where are they?"
"With their mother. Look, I found you and brought you here. Everything is fine because of you. Name's Horace Young. I wrote an article. Let me read it to you."
He launched in, oblivious to Harley's protests.
"A true hero. The wealthy and famous Garrett Vanderveer will be pleased to know that early this morning, James Harley, his stalwart stevedore and head foreman, despite having suffered a crippling blow to his head during the flood, carried two boys on his back to the safety of the intersection of Westerloo and Grand Streets in the low-lying pastures neighborhood, after which he then collapsed. He was operated on at City Hospital by Dr. William Stipp and lightly assisted by his wife, Albany's famous native daughter, the former Miss Mary Sutter, who defied the usual squeamishness of her sex to become a doctor. But in a coquettish display of temper, Mrs. Stipp declined to outline for this concerned reporter Mr. Harley's prognosis. Perhaps such unprofessional behavior is to be expected, for in the past 6 weeks it is known that Mrs. Stipp exhausted herself in an endless and ultimately futile search for the two O'Donnell sisters, lost in the winter blizzard. No doubt she is now unhinged with grief, for on Wednesday last, the Stipp and Sutter family finally set a stone in remembrance of them in our magnificent Albany Rural Cemetery."
The reporter grinned, his teeth gleaming through an untended mustache as he tapped the newspaper against Harley's chest.
"Good, yes?"
The article had prompted in Harley ghostly flashes of wading through water and a frightening feeling of drowning. But clarity remained a flickering goal, just out of reach. There had been a flood, apparently. And he had rescued not Emma and Claire, but two boys he had no memory of. Harley concentrated on breathing, trying to calm the throbbing in his neck. But all he could think about was the girls. Where were they? Were they safe? Still in the house? Why couldn't he remember? He hoped they were alive, hoped they were all right. He'd often thought he ought to give them back, but that had been impossible, wishful dreaming. He'd grown awfully fond of them in the past weeks. He'd done everything he could for them. It was like losing his own children now, not knowing where they were. A wave of remorse washed over him. What if they were dead? Oh, his darling girls. He rose on one elbow, leaned over the side of the bed, and retched at Young's feet.
"James Harley,"
a disembodied voice thundered from the hallway.
Never before had Captain Mantell's coarse tones roused terror in Harley. But they did now. He had lost the girls, and he didn't know where they were. Young rose and stuck his head out the door.
"Harley's here. Who's asking?"
"Who are you?"
Mantell said, his considerable bulk filling the doorframe. Young offered his hand.
"Horace Young, the Argus."
"Could you excuse us? Police business,"
Mantell said, steering the reporter into the hallway and shutting the door on him. Mantell took Young's seat and grinned at Harley, clearly mindful of the close quarters and Harley's fellow patients, who were staring now.
"I didn't mean to lose them," Harley said. "I love them, especially..."
Mantell leaned in and whispered,
"Who didn't you lose?"
Harley swallowed.
"I don't know." "God damn it, man," Mantell hissed. "Do you have those O'Donnell sisters or not?"
Harley tried to remember what he'd said before, but couldn't. Words seemed to float out of him of their own accord. But by the look on Mantell's face now, he feared he might have said too much.
"Sisters?" he finally rasped. "The whole of the pastures is under water," Mantell said,
still whispering, still leaning in.
"Did you leave them in the house while you were busy rescuing neighbors? Is that where they are? Drowned? Are you responsible for that?"
Tears slid down Harley's cheeks. Oh, his beloveds. His head was clearing, the nausea fading. The back of his neck ached, and he reached for the wound, hoping it would remind him of what had occurred. A murky memory returned, of Emma and a coal shovel. He scrambled to find some explanation now that would appease Mantell, but couldn't. He was terrified of the man, who flared at the slightest provocation. The girls might be dead. Oh, it was too terrible. Had there been water in the basement when he went down to fetch them? Or had he left the door open at the top of the stairs? Maybe they had escaped. That thought was even more terrifying. It was him they knew. Him they would recognize.
"I remember nothing,"
he said, hoping to put the police captain off. Garrett Vanderveer strode into the room, a rakish bandage affixed above his left eye. Mantell rose and shook Vanderveer's hand, turning affable. A clap to the back, an extended hand, a hearty shake.
"What happened to you, Vanderveer?" Mantell said. "Don't tell me you were mucking around in the water, too." "I was down at the river last night. My son was caught in the district. I slipped. What are you doing here?" "Just visiting our hero. Oh, you read about him in the paper. Did you see the article?" "Bought one from a newsboy, just as I came in. You had time in the middle of all this?"
Garrett made a gesture that seemed to encompass the whole city.
"To pay tribute to my overseer? I just went off duty. Harley will be up for a medal, I say. You should be proud. Such a public display of bravery. Two little boys. Display of courage beyond compare. Speaking of courage, my son hightailed it off the ice this morning. He was caught in the flooding. Waited on the roof all night. Saved my books,"
Garrett said.
"Loyal boy," Mantell said.
A nurse appeared, carrying a tray of gauze and bandage scissors, a brown bottle of iodine balanced between them. "Excuse me, gentlemen, but I need to change Mr. Harley's dressing." Mantell and Vanderveer stepped outside, into the hallway, out of Harley's sight. The nurse was asking Harley whether he was still nauseated. He was, but it was no longer due to the effects of the anesthetic. She set about her work, tisking and fretting as she dabbed his neck and bandaged him, saying he was to keep his hands away. She offered him a sip of sarsaparilla and a pill to swallow, something for the pain, and helped him to lie back down again. The promise of an imminent release from pain soothed his grave worry of whether or not the girls were dead. Or maybe that was the morphine talking. Mantell had been furious, but the captain was furious most of the time. It's what made him so good at his job. After all, through force of will, the man had managed to dissuade the Stips that their girls were alive. That had been extremely helpful. And Harley would do anything now to keep up that fiction. If only he could stay awake. But the morphine was already warming his stomach and spreading to his bones. Chapter 23. Upstairs in the Stips' house, Emma and Claire lay asleep under the light covers of a white sheet in the lying-in room Amelia maintained for the odd woman in labor who didn't want to deliver in her own home. The two girls were in Claire's bed, where Emma had crawled earlier, and where they had fallen, as Mary had hoped they would, under the narcotic spell of the morphine pills she had given them. The room had gone humid with their deep sleep. Flung outside the sheets, Emma's bruised and abraded arms encircled Claire's tiny body. Claire's mouth was slightly open, and her hands clasped Emma's. Their sleep was not so much sleep as an exhausted swoon. Mary dropped to one knee beside their bed. She did not notice Amelia unlocking a window and cracking open its bottom sash. Nor did she hear William pacing outside the door, impatient to learn the girl's condition, but unwilling to breach their modesty. As was she. But she was certain that the girls would not be able to tolerate what she was about to do if they were conscious. They were too devastated, too crippled by fear. But she had to examine them, not only to ascertain the state of their health, but also to catalog for the police the extent and nature of their injuries. Under any other circumstance, she would never commit the intrusion. But this was no ordinary situation. First, Mary ran a cursory gaze over the sleeping forms, confirming that the girls' nail beds were pink. If either of them were bleeding internally, they would be white. Their skin, though, was as pale as bleached linen, though it was not the alarming pallor of acute anemia. Instead, it seemed only as if they hadn't seen the sun in a long while. Their breathing, too, was even and not depressed, indicating that they were tolerating the morphine well. They showed no signs of acute starvation. She and William had treated some of the survivors of Andersonville years after their release from the deadly Confederate prison, but the girls evinced none of the dry, cracked skin, atrophied muscles, or sunken cheeks of malnourishment. Now Mary began her formal exams. She started with Claire, easing back the top sheet, taking care not to wake either of them as she inched Claire from Emma's protective grasp. She inspected every inch of Claire's body, hunting for clues, taking her time, turning her gently so that she did not waken. Claire's body betrayed no marks, no signs of intrusion, nary even a bruise, only an insignificant rash on the underside of one forearm. Mary, intent on thoroughness, opened Claire's mouth, ran her hands along her scalp, felt along the length of her neck and under her arms for swollen lymph nodes, palpated her abdomen for resistance that might reveal swelling or damage, moved all her limbs in succession to assess for breaks or sprains, and finally propped her legs up in a V and hunted for signs of intrusion. There were none. Claire's body was fully intact. Mary tucked the soft white cotton of Claire's nightgown around her sleeping body and circled the bed to kneel beside Emma. It took a moment to splice together the specter of Emma's youth with the extent of the assault. As had been clear during her bath, an array of bruising,
yellowing and purple, marred one of Emma's shoulders, and the bruising extended to either side of her rib cage, along the crests of her pelvic bones, and down her back, where more abrasions marred her scapulae and spine. Scratches traveled up the length of her spindled thighs. A long splinter was embedded in the flesh of the right inner thigh. In her life and practice, Mary had grown accustomed to a great deal, bearing witness to more pain than most, but now her hands were shaking. She admonished herself to be methodical, disciplined, objective. She palpated every joint and bone, percussed every inch of Emma's abdomen, turned her neck and head, looking for spinal problems. She auscultated Emma's lungs, worried about pneumonia, reminded herself to do the same for Claire. She turned to Emma this way and that, tested her reflexes, ran her hands over the worst of the bruises, and discovered, to her relief, that the bruising, while extensive, was superficial. Luckily, Emma had suffered no broken bones, damage to any internal organs, or bumps on her scalp to indicate concussion. She still had the last of the exam to do. Again, she propped open Emma's legs and steeled herself. The tissue was swollen, inflamed, torn, typical of the kind of injury rendered during repeated traumatic entry. No, she berated herself, that medical term was too evasive. She needed to use the real word. During rape. She also needed to stay focused. She needed to note everything. No gonorrheal exudate. No cankers indicative of syphilis. Something to be grateful for. And Emma was not yet in puberty, a relief of such immense proportions that the cuts and tears seemed a dispensation in comparison to the disaster pregnancy would have been. At some point, Amelia had left and returned with a Diefenbach needle holder, toothed forceps, sutures, and gauze. Now, Mary took a deep breath, pushing away a sudden wave of fury. From the second she had begun, she had had to stifle her anger, and she still had to now, or her hands would not be able to do their meticulous work. "Shut your mind," Mary told herself. "Shut your mind and do not think of who or what this is. Think only, layer by layer. Rebuild from the bottom up. Use enough but not too many stitches. Be conservative. Do no further harm. Preserve tissue and function." Mary shot a despairing but determined look at her mother, took up her instruments, and began the work of putting Emma back together. Chapter 24. They had once again taken refuge around the dining table. It was 5 o'clock, 6 weeks since the blizzard, 20 hours since the ice had broken, 9 hours since Emma and Claire had materialized on the veranda, 2 since Mary had finished the heart-rending work of repairing Emma. Vera had made a roast of lamb and potatoes, cooling untouched on a platter in the middle of the table. Upstairs, Emma and Claire were sleeping. Mary had given them a second dose of morphine when they began to emerge from the first, and they again fell safely under its narcotic, amnesiac tide. Throughout the afternoon, Amelia and Mary had looked in on them and found them buried beneath the sheets, softly breathing. They were all tired. None of them had slept since returning from the hospital. From the scullery came the sound of Vera washing pots and pans. From time to time, she broke down sobbing. Mary had finally relieved herself of her tight button boots, donning slippers in their place. She still wore the evening dress that she had worn to the party, and toiled in all night and day. William fixed his gaze on his wife. She had relayed the unimaginable details in a desultory way, her usual fierceness dimmed by what he would determine in anyone else to be shocked.